Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased here to have back on the program once again Phil Nixon. He is an extension specialist in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences and has been with us off and on for a number of years here to try to help you out with insect pest problems around the home. This can be something that's actually in the house, can be in the yard and home garden. And if it's a real problem, if it's something that you cannot live with, call in, tell us about it, give us the best description so he can figure out what it is you're talking about, and then he can tell you what to do about it. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
We have talked before, and I'm sure people by this point have heard about the emerald ash borer, which is an insect. It's not native to the United States, came from Asia, and it's a real concern because if nothing is done to check its spread within, I don't know, maybe a couple of generations, we could actually see all the ash trees gone.
That's correct.
So now there are some scientists who are considering the introducing another insect, or more
actually
than one.
Actually, three. Yeah.
These are parasitic wasps. Mm-hmm. They don't sting people,
right,
but they go after the ash borers as a way of controlling them. And this, I guess, is something of a gamble. Anytime that you introduce something that's not native, you can never be quite sure what the impact on the ecosystem is going to be when you put this thing in there that wasn't there before.
Right. Of course, we already know what the stakes are not introducing something. We're going to end up with probably losing our ash and in the process have a lot more insecticide applications. So there are, we know one side of the equation. They've looked at these free parasitic wasps or parasitoids. They are very tiny things. If a person saw them, they'd think, hey, we're seeing a gnat. About an eighth of an inch long is tops them out. There's three of them. One attacks the eggs of the emerald ash borer. One is what they call an ectoparasite. The larva feeds on the outside of a larva of the emerald ash borer. And the third one is an endoparasite. The larva feeds on the inside of the emerald ash borer. And each one of them will control, at least in what they've been able to see in China and other areas where they've been looking at emerald ash borer, primarily in China, and looking at this, that they control, each one of them controls anywhere from 30 to 60% of a population. So by the time you put a triple whammy onto them, there's a real possibility that trees could survive with a low-level emerald ash borer infestation without any insecticides being applied. These would provide that much control. Mm-hmm. In practicality, probably 90%, I believe somewhere around 90% of all natural enemy introductions, which this would be, really don't do the job. So there's a real good chance that it wouldn't work. The problem comes about is, okay, what are these going to do here to something else? They've done some tests. USDA scientists primarily have done some tests and looked at how well they would parasitize what I like to call lab rat bugs, various insects that they reproduce in the lab easily, and they don't go after those. They've tried some various borers, and they don't seem to go after those much, although they will attack some of the borers in the same genus as the emerald ash borer. That's the genus Agrylis. And in North America, we have 161 known species of Agrylis that are all borers in various types of trees and shrubs and other plants. In northeastern United States, 57 species. I looked at all 57 species to see what they would attack, and most of them attack trees and shrubs that we would prefer to have. So losing a few of those would actually be a benefit. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of free exceptions. One is that one species attacks poison ivy. So theoretically, if you had something as a wasp that was killing off some of the borers that were attacking the poison ivy, you might end up with more poison ivy because there's not many borers killing the poison ivy. Now, one attacks bristly locusts, which in some parts of the country are used as a very important erosion control plant, but in many other parts of the country considered to be a darn weed, which is prickly and you can't really walk through the stuff. And then there's a third plant that we really wouldn't care a whole lot to have that they will attack. So in this situation, you look to see what would they kill that might actually increase a plant pest problem we already have. and it doesn't appear that it's all that great of that type of thing. But I like to say we're trying to, you know, essentially getting emerald ash borer into this country was kind of like Pandora's box getting opened a little bit. And now we're trying to close that box by opening it again, by bringing in some other species. So there's always a risk, and you never know, absolutely certain, what they will attack and how far and how well they will survive until you let them go. And then, of course, it's too late to bring them back in. So there's a risk there. There definitely is. I think in total, in my opinion, the possibilities of it being able to control the emerald ash borer to a great extent and help us keep our ashes, the real possibility of reducing the amount of insecticides applied to help control emerald ash borer, it's probably a good trade-off. The risk is probably worth it, in my mind. But there are other entomologists that would feel totally different, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, we were talking about this just very briefly yesterday. May Barenbaum was here. She's head of the entomology department at the U of I. And one of the things she observed, and we might have talked about this, is that using insecticide to control borers is difficult. The challenge is that they bore into the tree. So actually making sure that they come in contact with the pesticide is sometimes really difficult.
Yeah, the insecticides that we're primarily using against this borer are actually transmitted by the xylem, the water and nutrient conducting tissues, and to the borer. However, this borer attacks the most active xylem tissue and destroys it. So, in fact, your delivery method that you're wanting to use to get to the borer is being destroyed by the borer before it gets to it, to a certain extent. And as most borers, as a result, are difficult to control for that reason, you about have to have, ideally, you have a preventative system wherein you actually treat the tree before it gets a borer, gets it very bad, so that you haven't essentially wiped out the pipeline you're going to use to get the material to where the insect is.
Yeah. One more quick question here, then I promise we have a caller here in Urbana we're going to get to. We're here in Champaign County. In Champaign County and sort of the area here around us, has the emerald ash borer actually been seen?
No, it has not. And it has not been seen. The closest it has been seen is essentially in some areas of Kane County, which are probably about 130, 140 miles away from here.
Okay.
So without somebody transporting it in firewood or in young trees or something like this, on its own devices, it would take somewhere around a quarter of a millennium to get here. Moves about a half a mile a year. So we're looking at 260 years for it to get here on its own. Now, no entomologists in this area probably feel that it's going to take that long to get here, but it's, we all buy insurance policies with the idea of the uncertainty principle, not knowing what's happening, and so certainly there is a possibility that there's a tree right outside this building that has it in it, and we haven't seen it yet. So that's always a potential, and that's what we are concerned about the most. That's why we try to let people know about it and try to avoid moving of ash wood to try to avoid moving this insect around.
Yeah. So if today, say, and I think we might actually have had a question like this, or maybe it was when Sandy was on, I don't know. So today someone says to you, well, I'd like to plant a tree in my yard, and I had kind of been thinking about planting an ash. Would you say, no, don't do it? Or would you say, it's okay, go ahead and plant your ash tree?
I would not dismiss planting an ash tree out of hand. However, I'm recommending, the International Society of Arboriculture, Society of People that Work on Trees, tree surgeons, if you want to look at them that way, they recommend that no tree should be more than 10% of the total population of trees. In Illinois, our native area percentage of ash statewide is around 3.8%. And so what I've been telling municipal people, park district people, and so on, I would work towards getting my ash down to no more than 5% of the trees, because you're assuming you're going to lose them, and if you lose one out of 20 trees, neither you nor your clientele are going to notice that loss all that terribly much. And so my response to somebody want to know, should I plant an ash in my yard, is, well, are there other ashes in the vicinity? Almost assuredly there are. Are there at least 5%? Probably is, probably more like 15%. No, you should not plant an ash tree. However, if you're in an area where they've avoided planting ash trees and you're going to plant the only ash tree in the whole darn housing development, fine, go for it. You know, The idea being that if you lose that tree, you lose a major tree in your yard, it's still a major loss. But on the other side of a coin, it's not like you won't have other trees to look at.
Yeah. All right. Phil Nixon is our guest. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I. Every once in a while, he's here to answer questions about dealing with insect control around the home. If you have a problem in the house, in your yard, in your home garden, give us a call. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have two callers ready to go. They're both in Urbana. First, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Got two questions. One is, are there emerald ash borer lookalikes that the average person who just sees it very shortly might say, what is that? And then the second question is about carpenter bees and when one can safely block up their holes, assuming that they have hatched and come out and won't drill through the wood.
Good question.
Questions.
The first one, there's a number of things, both as borers and as adult beetles or adult insects, that to the average person would look somewhat like an emerald ash borer. We get the idea that there surely can't be any insects that are emerald green in color, metallic emerald green in color, but in fact there's an insect that's about the same size, which is very common, a tiger beetle, which you'll find an active individual on the sunshine on your sidewalk commonly. We have a ground beetle, which is quite common, about the same size and a little bit wider that looks a lot like an emerald ash borer. They'll come to lights at night. We have another tiger beetle that looks a lot like the emerald ash borer. We have some sweat bees that look very much like the emerald ash borer. So some people get the idea if it's metallic green, it must be an emerald ash borer because, gosh, I've been on this earth for 30 years, 40 years, 60 years, 80 years. I ain't never seen one of those types of things. Well, they're out there, and I have. So, and the more you look for it, the more you see them. So, yeah, there are things like that. More importantly, is that there are insects that will somewhat mimic the damage. The emergence holes of an emerald ash borer are an eighth of an inch wide, and they're D-shaped, flat on one side, round on the other. We don't have anything else in ash that does that kind of an exit hole, but we have one that's very common, the ash and privet borer, which makes an oval hole, which is 3/16 of an inch across. So it's a little bit bigger. It's not really flat on one side, but boy, if you're looking to see if it's D-shaped, you look at an oval and you can almost make your mind think that it's D-shaped. We have another exceedingly common insect called a round-headed ash borer, which makes a round hole an eighth of an inch across. So it's the same distance, but it's not flat on one side. So, you know, there are some, and these are exceedingly common insects on ash, particularly those that are under stress. Or these are both borers that attack dead and dying parts of trees, ones that have died from some other reason, storm damage or physical injury or something like that. So, yeah, there are some things, so much so that I actually got a call about a year and a half ago from a person who was enrolling his daughter into a college, and right outside her dormitory there were several ash trees. And this gentleman worked for the Michigan Department of Agriculture, and he said, "I have seen thousands of emerald ash borers. I looked at the holes in this tree. You absolutely, definitely, no questions asked, have emerald ash borer. I know what they are. I know what they look like. I'm an expert on it. I know it." I went up there. They were ash privet borers, thankfully. And a couple other people, not just me, but a couple other people that knew what they looked like went up there and saw it. So even a trained eye can mistake these. And so we do get a lot of calls of people that are seeing things that's not it. As far as your carpenter bees go, I would not caulk the holes until you get into the fall. What's the fall? I'd say by the time you get to mid or late September, you're probably safe. And caulk the hole and get a nice day, caulk the hole and paint over that area, or put a paintable stain on it, and that should help keep carpenter bees from getting back in. But, yeah, we get a lot of people who I don't quite understand. They've got an insect that's tunneling through wood, and they think that if I close off a hole, all the young ones growing up inside will die. They can't get out. Well, they just eat their own hole out through the wood. That's not a big deal. They're made to do that. And so instead of one hole, you end up with four, five, six, seven holes for each hole which you clog up. So I'd wait until mid-September before I'd close them up.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Urbana again. This is our next caller. Someone on line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. About 7 years ago, when we remodeled our kitchen, we had a strange problem. Every late spring, early summer, we get this swarming of some flying ants inside the room. And these flying ants are clearly in trouble because they seem to be attracted to the light, and then mm-hmm. they fall all over the place and into your food. And it goes on for about a month or so, and I put down poison which controls it, but I really hate doing that because I like try not to put down poison on ants, but when they come into the house, they're a real problem. And they're not like the little sugar ants or things that crawl. They fly, and so they're clearly some kind of mating and swarming. And I'm wondering whether there's something more appropriate that I can do to handle them every spring.
Do these have a pinched-in waist like
yes,
an ant has?
Do.
Okay.
Yes,
yeah, we just want to make sure that they were not termites. Termites will have a
don't.
Broad waist, and the body doesn't go to the end of the wings, but with ants it usually does.
No, I thought initially they were, but
yeah.
I've been told that they're not.
Yeah, what the ants want to do is they want to get outside and have sex and start a new colony. and so that's why they go to the windows. And my reaction would be that just vacuum off the windows of your vacuum cleaner every morning. They'll come out in the early morning hours, and they'll go to the window that happens to be lit in the early morning. So they most commonly show up in the east windows because that's where the sun comes up.
Yeah, it's an east room.
Yeah, and they may be coming out elsewhere in the house, but they're flying to that room because it's the lit one. You might want to look around the foundation. You may be find some cracks and crevices you can caulk. This may help prevent the problem from recurring. However, chances are you have a nest very close to the foundation where if you're not being bothered by ants, otherwise they're just they're out doing their things outside, and then when they release the adults, some of them get inside and show up this way. I'm guessing it's some because normally when one of these things produces winged individuals, a single colony would probably produce several hundred individuals. I mean, you'd have piles of dead bodies.
That's correct.
So I would, what I would use is I would just vacuum them off when they show up. They're going to do that every morning for about three or four mornings straight, maybe five. And then it'll be several months before they do it again, and that'll probably be it for the year. That's probably the way I would handle it personally. If you're okay with that, that sounds like a good option.
Well, it seems to be more than that and only at one time of the year. And I put down poison around the foundation of the house outside.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be more efficient than... I hate putting poison inside because we have a dog.
Well, I hate putting it outside because you're killing ants that aren't really the problem ones that are being problems. And
that's
they're,
true,
they're
but
useful
it's only around the foundation.
But you've probably got a good justification here.
Yes.
Caulking, using an expandable, flexible caulk like a silicone caulking compound will help... should help keep them out, but there's just as likely that the opening they're using is below ground, and so all
that's
the caulking in the world won't do you a whole lot of good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. On to Champagne. This next caller is in Champagne, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, I want to get back to boars again, but I want to get back to iris boars.
Okay.
I have iris here, and I have iris in other places, and I think I brought the boars with me when I moved here because... I just dug up all my iris, put them down in water, got all the boars out, but I don't know about replanting them, and I've ordered some new ones, but I don't want to perpetuate the problem. They're horrible.
Expensive. Yeah. What we get is, for those listeners who don't know what we're talking about, this is a borer that will tunnel through the corm of the iris.
Right.
And essentially destroys it. For the tall bearded varieties, the kind your grandmother used to grow, it gets them very commonly, but usually the corms are big enough that it can cope with them in many cases and not really be seriously damaged. The smaller corm varieties get them less often, such as Louisiana, Japanese, these types of irises. But when they do get them, the corm is so small that it kills the plant, typically.
Right.
What will happen is that the eggs are laid in the late summer, early fall, and as I remember, maybe it's early spring. At any rate, the answer is that you will see... water-soaked areas in the fans and the leaves of the iris when they're first coming up in the spring. And this mm-hmm. is the borer will start out as a leaf miner that will tunnel down through the leaves, so the eggs are going to be laid in the spring, and go down to the corm. And if you can catch them in the leaves, that's your best option. We recommend spraying the fans or the leaves when they're about 6 inches high with acephate, which is soda's orthene. And this will go inside the leaf and hopefully kill the borer as it's going down through the leaf. And it will also, if you spray it well enough so that some runs off onto the ground, you'll get some soaking in around the corms there and will help control the ones that are feeding on the corm. So that's probably your best bet. The insecticide that used to work very well for that has been taken off the market for residential use. So.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah. Great. Well, what I still, so I didn't put them back. The ones that I could save, that should have enough fatness to them to save, I didn't put them back in the same place. I put them in a whole different part of the yard because I was afraid that I'd have something in the soil there.
Yeah, they may have already come out and pupated. It's hard to say. I'm not really certain how they, what stage overwinter in. But the but many people have good results of just digging them up and pulling out the borers and planting them again.
That's what I've been doing.
And those are much better iris growers than I am. Every time I've ever tried to transplant iris, I've paid a penalty about 2 years of no bloom for that. So digging them up every year would mean I never get any iris blooms, which kind of eliminates the reason for having iris, in my opinion. So, but a lot of people have much better luck than that, and so that is an option, and that does work for many people. But I would recommend the ornithine when the fans are about 4 to 6 inches high, somewhere around in there, particularly if you start seeing the water stroke streaks on the leaves.
So if I spray them when they're in the spring, when they're at that height, I'm going to kill them from the little
kill them before they get down
into the corm.
You get them, kill them before they get down to the corm.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. We are already at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I and is with us periodically. We ask him to come by several times throughout the year to answer questions about dealing with insect pest problems in the home. Can be something in the house, can be in the home landscape, in the yard and the garden. Just give us the best description you can of the problem, and he'll tell you what to do about it. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in McLean County, line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I want to ask about the annual perpetual problem called the Japanese beetle. Just want to make sure I understand. Are they here forever?
Oh, yes. they have naturalized completely.
Okay.
So, they will be here every year. You're not going to get rid of them. In fact, the only thing they're going to do is probably spread and become more numerous farther west of here. And they'll fill in the spaces they haven't gotten to yet in Illinois. And there are many rural areas between that do not have them yet, particularly in the central part of the state. So, they will fill in and they will become more of a problem. At this time of year, they're out feeding on the leaves of various trees and shrubs, and we recommend you can hand-pick them off, particularly late in the afternoon or in the evening. If you poke at them, they'll fold their legs and drop straight down. If you hold a container that has some rubbing alcohol or soapy water in it, that will kill them. And you can collect a pint or so a night. And if you do that at least every other night for a couple of weeks, greatly reduce the amount of damage and the amount of damage you'd have the rest of the season. Spray-wise, we're looking at Carbaryl, which is sold as 7, or Cyfluthrin, which is sold as Bayer Advanced Garden Multi-Insect Killer. And this is applied every other week while they're heavy, and they'll be heavy through about the middle of August.
Okay, till August, okay.
Middle of August, okay.
I've been told we've used 7 because I saw one like a couple weeks ago. And then we were out of town, so we couldn't spray. And within 1 week, like a week later, they were numerous and just very destructive. But we were wondering that when you spray with 7, I keep hearing that they're a contact spray.
We used to think that it was only a contact spray, but particularly what we were finding was that it was working for 2 weeks with Japanese beetle, and that didn't make any sense because we knew it was breaking down in about 3 days on the outside of a plant, particularly in the hot, sunny days that we have this time of year. And so they did some more looking at it, and they found out that it actually is translaminarly systemic, which is a fancy way of saying that it goes inside the leaf, but it doesn't go to the rest of the plant. But it will go inside the leaf and inside the tissues of the leaf, and as such, it hangs on longer than it would if it was just on the outside. The 7 is primarily a stomach poison type thing. The insects, you get some contact kill. If you hit them with it, it will kill them some. But primarily they have to eat it, and when it goes inside the leaf, it really works well that way. So with Japanese beetles, we actually found out that it did a little more than we ever gave it credit for. And that stuff's been around since 58.
Yeah. So when they eat the leaves like a week later, they're still dying from it.
That's correct.
Okay, that's good. Because we kept thinking that we sprayed it, and it's been a week now.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen hardly any. And I'm glad you mentioned the every other spraying every other week, not every week.
Yeah, in my own yard, if I use it, and as well as feedback from other people, I'm seeing that generally you can get by with every other week application, and it does pretty well. I always get a few people that say that I'm crazy and loony and don't know what I'm talking about, and they have to go out there and spray it for every 3 days. But most people that I talk to say, yeah, you know, if you're not real... You realize you're not going to get rid of every single Japanese beetle on the planet. What you're trying to do is get rid of the thundering horde, and every other week we'll do that.
How about prevention?
Prevention is essentially impossible, except that there is an application of an insecticide, imidacloprid, which is systemic, that if you apply it by within at least two months out from when you need it, it will go through the tree and provide control, and that's sold as Bayer Advanced Garden Tree and Shrub Insect Control. There's also neem oil, which is an organic material that is particularly effective as a repellent. And that means that if you put it on starting around the third week of June and apply it, that you may be able to repel the insects from your plants. It's probably a little bit late for that to work real well. It does kill the insects too, but it works best as a repellent. And so those are other options that you can do. Neem oil is available at many garden centers.
Okay. So if we bring it in like ahead of time, so like maybe even mid-June or...
Yeah.
Yeah, I finally figured out it comes almost like the solstice.
Yeah. Well, yeah, about right. Yeah, we normally expect our first reports of fairly high numbers of Japanese beetles either on June 21 or 22. So, yeah, right at the first day of summer.
Could you spell the name of the other application you were talking about? And do you apply it on the tree, or someone was talking about those applications you can apply on the ground, too?
The one to the soil is the imidacloprid, which is imidacloprid. And that's going to be sold as Bayer, same company as makes your aspirin, Bayer Advanced Garden Tree and Shrub Insect Control.
And the one that you spray on trees?
Spray on trees is either carbaryl, which that's the common name for seven, S-E-V-I-N, or cyfluthrin, which is the common name for Bayer Advanced Garden Multi-Insect Killer.
Okay, and that's the prevention also, the Bayer Advanced?
The Bayer Advanced Garden Multi-Insect Killer is one that will kill the beetles that are currently on the plant and last for about 2 weeks.
Okay, so that's really not, so Bayer or seven are not prevention, they're really actually...
The multi-insect killer and the seven are actually ones when you already have a problem.
Right.
The Bayer Advanced Garden Tree and Shrub Insect Control is the preventative material.
Okay. There are two of them that will...
There are different chemicals in these two different containers.
Great. Well, thank you very, very much.
All right, thanks. Just one more thing. You use something like seven. That is a broad-spectrum
right.
killer. It will kill a... Not only will it kill Japanese beetles, it'll kill a lot of other things. Is this? Do you need to worry about killing insects that you perhaps don't want?
Well, certainly. You need to be very careful with particularly seven, and even with the cyfluthrin, the multi-insect killer, of spraying blossoms with it, and particularly blossoms that are going to be visited by pollinating insects, such as butterflies, moths, flies, beetles, these sorts of things, bees and wasps. And so, you know, a lot of rose growers say, well, that's what they're eating. That's what I want to control. Well, if you look at your roses and if you observe them, most of the fancier roses that have double blooms have quite frankly had the insect attractant, the nectar and the pollen bred out of them. And so if you observe your plants and find out that you really have never seen any bees or anything on those plants, that means as far as nectar or pollen for pollinating insects, they're a zero, and you're probably okay spraying them with these products. Mm-hmm. But you need to be observant. Most single-flowered roses will be attractive, and many of your more less highly bred things, like some of your rugosa roses, will get them. I've had them before. Had a lot of pollinators come into my fairy rose, and Japanese beetle really love those, and it's a double rose. So you've got to watch to see what they're doing and before you would spray blossoms. Otherwise, you may be seeing fewer butterflies and other things you really like to have.
All right. Let's talk next with another caller. Princeton, Indiana is the caller, and this is line 4, toll-free line right here. Hello.
Well, I have another question on white ash. I have a lot of them in around my house, and so I've had a bunch of them cut down and cut up into firewood, which I have not hauled off the premises. But I'm not sure what they're being killed by. I don't know whether it's emerald ash borer or something else, but it's clearly a borer doing a lot of damage. Some of the trees that I thought would be dead by now aren't. And so I'm wondering, is it worthwhile to get the Bayer advanced tree and shrub stuff this fall and try to...
Well, I think the first step is to figure out what's killing your ash trees. There are a couple of very serious diseases that attack ash, an environmental problem. If they get dry, they'll die anywhere from the next year to a decade later. If they're older established trees and you mess around with their root systems, that can take them out. They're planted too deep. Once they get up to a good size, they die.
These are only moderate-sized trees,
okay.
Maybe 6 to 10 inches.
Okay. Probably your best bet is to take some photographs of a tree overall, some of the borer holes. If you've got any insects, take those with you and go to your local University of Illinois Extension office,
And
they will try to help you with your problem. And if they don't know the answer, they have an email system that for identification and stuff that it works through the system. And if it doesn't, nobody else can figure it out. If it's an insect, it eventually gets to me. I'm where the buck stops.
All right.
For the whole state. So start at your local extension office. They may know right out of hand what's happening, but at any rate, they can send it on up the line, and we'll get an answer for you.
Okay, well, if the problem is directly from the borers and not that they are the opportunistic ones that came after something else.
Well, that's the problem that we don't know. You know, you can get ash yellows is very common getting into ash trees. There's some decline from dryness, from other types of soil conditions.
Yeah.
All of these will result in opportunistic borers coming in secondarily and attacking the tree. So just because you have holes in the tree doesn't mean that the borers are the main problem, the original problem. There may be something you can do to stop it without going after the borers directly.
I don't see a lot of holes. When we cut it down, I see an awful lot of damage.
Of tunneling?
And what the symptom is that the branches start dying off one at a time, and the tree sort of thins out until finally there's nothing alive.
That sounds like several different things. So it's probably going to take, it may end up taking eventually a sample that would go to the plant clinic. That'll usually cost $12.50, but it sounds like it would be well worth it to find out that information. And that's at the University of Illinois as well. But I'd work through it. I don't think almost all of the ash problems that I see that people call in about borers are secondary. Something else was bothering that tree first. Sometimes it's still correctable. Certainly, if you've got a lot of ash trees, it's probably correctable for at least some of your ash trees.
Sorry, I missed that.
You've got a lot of ash trees, like apparently you have, you may not be able to cure the ones that are most farthest gone, but you may be able to correct a problem that may save some of the remaining trees that still look pretty good.
Okay.
All right?
I'll follow what you suggested then.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
We will just keep on going here. The next is someone in Philo on a cell phone, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple of questions. One, is there a bunch of sawdust seems to be falling from a limb of a large maple tree. It looks like some large black ants. Are there such things as ants that do that?
And yeah.
And what do we do about them?
Okay.
Do they attack the house? The other question was in regard to something you said very early on about the emerald ash borer chemicals that you can... the invasive insects that people are thinking about bringing in if they took too many insects with that effect, like woodpeckers, who might eat such a thing. I don't know if they do or not.
Okay. I'll answer the second question first. It's a little bit easier. Certainly, woodpeckers have been having a field day in areas where there are emerald ash borer. In fact, woodpecker damage is something which is an easy early sign. When you scout for emerald ash borer, the people that look for it, they look for woodpecker damage on the tree and then start looking closer to see if that's the case. It's very, very diagnostic. Now, on the other side of a coin, one can easily say that the emerald ash borer, the woodpeckers did just fine before emerald ash borer was here. So although they might have a slight drop in numbers in areas that are heavily infested, because surely with all this, all these boars around, probably the woodpeckers are having more young per year that are growing up, and there may be more woodpeckers in an area. One could say that if you help got rid of a lot of the emerald ash borer, that the woodpecker numbers would drop back to what their general ecology could support. So in the long run, that would be probably not a bad thing. We don't feel that these parasitic wasps attack very much in the way of other borers, so we're not looking at widespread loss of borers that woodpeckers would feed on. So I think probably the impact of a woodpecker population would be relatively minimal. It might have the effect of reducing the number back to where it was originally before they increased with increased emerald ash borer in the area, but that's not looked at as being a long-range problem. Eventually, as those trees would die from emerald ash borer, those woodpecker numbers would drop anyway, because when you cut the ash tree down, obviously you're not getting any more borers for the woodpeckers to feed on anyway. So you're eliminating the borers one way or the other, and thus impacting the increase that might have come in the woodpeckers because of a borer being there. That's kind of a long-winded answer, but getting back to your ants in the tree, there are carpenter ants. There are a number of carpenter ants that will occur in trees outside. They don't attack the live part of a tree. They may attack a living branch, being a living branch, but they will be hollowing out the dead part on the inside of a limb. If it's a major limb, if it's a trunk of a tree, then it could weaken the tree to where it's likely to fall over in a good windstorm. And might fall through your bedroom or something in the middle of the night. So if it's a major part of a tree, it's probably a good idea to have an arborist, a tree expert out to check on that tree and make sure that it's not a safety hazard. Usually ants get into the center of a tree that's already got some wood rot, so you've already got weakening of the tree to start with when those get in. There is one carpenter ant species in Illinois, the Campanotus pennsylvanicus, the black carpenter ant, which is at least a quarter of an inch long and black, and it will come into houses. We have a lot of other carpenter ant species that will not come into houses. It just stay outside and do their thing.
I think we see those in the house.
Yeah. The most common one that's in our yards are going to be the black carpenter ant, and they will get into wood that is damp. And so prevention of black carpenter ants is not worrying so much about the ants and the trees outside, but taking care of moisture problems that you have inside. A roofy leak, a water drain, leaky water drain pipes. These things need to be addressed promptly, and then kind of watch that area. Sometimes you'll get a nest in an area where you've got some damp wood, but you won't really see many ants in the house for about 5 years. Keep in mind that you had that problem, and if you do sign the ants, it may need involve going in and replacing some wood or soaking the ant nest with an ant and roach spray. But generally, just an ant outside. If you don't have damp wood in the house, they're not likely to be a big problem coming in making a nest. You will probably see a few ants, maybe two or three a day, coming in looking for food from that nest outside. But generally, we don't recommend people control a carpenter ant nest in a tree outside unless it's a part of a thing that needs to be cut out anyway. Then you can cut out that part and you get rid of this nest and the place where a new nest might start.
So you're not recommending like spraying it with insect.
Generally, we don't. There are exceptions to that, but if we did, we'd probably look at a permethrin type application. It's going to be sold as 8 insect spray or various other brand names, that's permethrin, and that material is readily available in garden centers and hardware stores and so on. So,
right.
In general, we don't recommend treating outside nests just because they're not really a threat to the tree's health, and the ants are so ubiquitous, so common outside that getting rid of one nest is not going to make a big difference on how likely your house is to be attacked.
It's
a damp wood that you have to watch for. I have a little saying that if a tree is at least a foot in diameter on a trunk, and you stare at the trunk for 5 minutes during the summertime, and you do not see at least one carpenter ant go up that tree, you have your eyes shut. They're that common. Pick any tree, North America, growing season. I guarantee you can see a carpenter ant in 5 minutes watching the trunk.
There's some sawdust that seems to be falling.
Yeah, the sawdust is due to them hollowing out the inside of that wood. And, like I said, if it's a major branch, get a tree expert out to look at it. If it's a branch you really don't want, go ahead and lop it off. If it's you know, but otherwise, if a tree seems to be healthy, if it's not, if it should fall, it's not going to hurt anything, then there's probably nothing you need to do about it. It's hollowing out the inside of a tree. They are not going to kill that branch by being inside the center.
I see.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist with U of I, and occasionally he's here to talk about insect control. I just feel like, since we've talked on and off here, talking quite a bit about the emerald ash borer, just one more time, I think sure. We ought to underline the fact that if you were in Champaign-Urbana, the closest to you an ash borer has been seen, conclusively identified, a couple of hundred miles from here.
130, anyway.
Okay, 130. Kane, it said it's Kane County?
Kane County. Huh?
Okay, 130 miles.
We don't recommend treating ash trees unless there has been a sighting of an emerald ash borer within 10 to 12 miles of where you are. So we are not recommending people. Well, this show does get up into the area that does have emerald ash borer, but we do not recommend people in central Illinois or central Indiana to be spraying their tree. Well, in central Indiana, they have it in Indianapolis, so I can't say that completely. But certainly in central Illinois, you don't need to be treating your trees for emerald ash borer. Even if you did it yourself, it's $20 a year. If you have somebody do it for you, it's $100 to $150. Save that money for the next 10, 15, 20, 30, maybe 100, 200 years. You can do a lot with that kind of money over time.
Next caller is in Seymour, line 3. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
A couple of months ago, there was quite a bit of press about honeybees and about disappearance of honeybees. I guess my question is that we haven't heard about it for a while. Is that a problem? Is it a problem locally? And if so, what's the latest thoughts on it?
Well, it's called colony collapse disorder, and it occurs because they found colonies, particularly in areas where you had large commercial beekeepers that have many hives close together. They would find hives that had no adults or very few adults in them, lots of larvae, lots of food. The adults just were gone, most of them. And this has happened repeatedly in previous years. They have noticed that when it has happened before, it has not recurred to next year, which makes it more difficult to find an answer on one hand. On the other hand, because you're not there studying it when it happens. On the other hand, it's not something that becomes a major long-term factor. We have not had any reports of it occurring in Illinois. My guess is that it has occurred in Illinois, just hasn't been reported. But if you have a dead hive, what a beekeeper will do is they will get a new one in, and this is called a nuclear hive. It has a new queen in it, and they just start up, and within a few weeks they're up and going again. And so that's what most beekeepers do. Beekeepers lose colonies from not just colony collapse disorder, but they lose some every year to not having enough food to go through the winter. They collect honey and store honey as wintertime food. They can get diseases into the hive. They can get other insects that will eat up their colony. There's a variety of reasons, mites that attack them. There are a variety of reasons why a colony might die. Beekeepers have this happen all the time. They just start a new colony and sanitize or burn the old hive body so nothing gets transmitted, and they go on from there. And in reality, that's kind of what's happened across the country.
I was surprised because I have some peach trees and have a little bit of down fruit from time to time, and have seen bees from time to time, you know, feeding on the down fruit, and haven't seen too many this year. I just wondered if there was any correlation there.
There could be, but on the other hand, we've had, if you remember, those very, very severe winter couple weeks we had where the temperatures were very, very cold.
Right.
A lot of beehives would have died in those kind of situations. And then we had a good spring because it was relatively dry for nectar flow, but right now we get a lot of rain. When you get a lot of rain, the plants don't bloom much. The bees aren't getting a whole lot of nectar. This will cause some of their populations to drop. There's a lot of factors. It could be colony collapse disorder, but I can also name off four or five other things that might be resulting in you not seeing very many bees in your yard.
So it doesn't sound like a real long-term serious problem.
It has never been in the past. Of course, you never know when the next time it happens, if it's going to be a real hard thing. But the difference that's happened this year is that media picked up on it and broadcast it to the world, and that made it more of a situation than it has been before. Not saying it wasn't an important situation before that, it just didn't get the airplay. So So that's a factor there, and it is something that the industry has ways of handling, and they handle it primarily by just getting new colonies from elsewhere, which there are companies that just make their living doing that.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next caller is in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to belittle the topic over and over again, but the ash borer.
Mm-hmm.
There are various species of ash. Does it affect all ash the same?
It affects all ashes in the genus Fraxinus, which means of the ashes that occur in Illinois, we'd be looking at green ash, white ash, black ash, and blue ash. We also have mountain ash, which is not even in the same family as the other ash trees.
No, it's a different tree.
And it's a different Tartas tree. And we have wafer ash, which is, again, in another family. So just because that's ash in its name doesn't necessarily mean, but all of the true ashes of the genus Fraxinus in the ebony family are attacked and killed by this, but nothing outside of that genus, which is interesting. They've worked very hard at Michigan State trying to get this insect to attack and grow in other related plants like privets and lilacs and so on, and they just live for a very short time and die out. So they cannot survive in it. So really only the ashes are affected, but all of the true ashes.
That would affect an olive tree too, wouldn't it?
No, the olive tree is in a different genus.
I thought all ash and olive were together.
They are in the same family.
They're in the same family, just different.
But genus. But the olive is in the genus Olea,
yeah.
and the frass is in the genus Fraxinus.
Okay.
And the emerald ash borer does not attack anything out of the genus Fraxinus.
Hmm.
They have tried olive against it too, and it just won't survive in it.
Huh. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thank you. The ash is in the ebony family.
Yeah, in a large term of things. Yeah, or the olive family. It's the same family. Yeah,
well, that's interesting. I guess
members of the ebony family we think of as tropical, but it's a large family of trees.
Yeah. I know ash is hard.
Yeah,
I know.
That's why it makes good baseball bats, makes good furniture. Mm. Is that it is hardwood? Yeah, it's
absolutely
in the same family.
All right, let's go to line 1 and that champagne. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have roaches in my dishwasher.
Okay.
I haven't seen them on my counters or anywhere, but just in my dishwasher, if I'm loading it, say, at 10 o'clock at night, there's a juvenile and a big one, and I squish them.
The big ones are about a half an inch long and tan?
Yeah. Not really that big.
Okay, and the young ones have a couple black stripes behind the head?
Yeah.
Yeah, this would be the German cockroach, which is the most common.
Yeah.
There are roach baits that can be used, and you can't put them inside your dishwasher, but you can put them around the dishwasher. Probably you have some seals that may not be quite as good or something of that nature.
You're thinking just a few baits maybe underneath the plate.
Around in that area, and then you might want to put some sticky traps. These could be sold, bought as roach motels,
right,
or called sticky traps. Put them elsewhere around in your home, just to make sure that you know where they are. Particularly do it in the bathroom,
uh-huh,
and anywhere else where food is consumed. So if you like to eat in bed, do it on the bed in the bedroom. Do it on the couch. If you like to eat chips watching TV, because the roaches will be where the food is.
Right.
And make sure that they're not elsewhere. And then also caulk cracks and crevices, particularly in food cabinets, and make sure that you get your dishwasher tight. And would might even help push more towards the baits by making sure that when you wash your dishes and get done, unload your dishwasher and then clean out any small amounts of food debris that are in cracks and crevices. So you get those roaches a little more hungry, so they're more apt to take that bait.
Okay. Is borax effective? That's kind of an old
boric thing. Acid is effective, but it's also toxic to people, and
right,
worse off, it doesn't apparently taste bad to people. So they will. So it only should be in cracks and crevices where people or pets can't get into it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Uh-huh. Thank you. And line number 2 here in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I had a quick question about Japanese beetles. What do you think about Japanese beetle traps as opposed to, I've heard some people say they attract them in.
Yeah, Japanese beetle traps have been proven in some pretty extensive tests at University of Kentucky to actually increase the amount of damage in the vicinity of a trap. By vicinity of a trap, we mean within a couple hundred feet. So with tongue-in-cheek, I kind of make the comment, one of the best ways to use Japanese beetle traps is to give them to your neighbors for Christmas. But really, they will increase the number of, when the beetles are attracted to the trap from as much as 2 blocks away, it's definitely the case that although many go into the trap, many more just get to their trap area and then start feeding on what's around. So you actually increase your damage. We do not recommend their use.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Now, just is it the Japanese beetle that is also the grub that attacks turf grass?
Yes, the white grub that attacks turf grass. And before we got all the rain in the last couple of weeks, we were set up to have one tremendous white grub problem where we would end up using an irrigated turf. They will be attracted to that. Use imidacloprid, same material we're talking about with emerald ash borer, only it will be sold as Merit insecticide, or halophanazide, sold as Mach 2 or Scott's grub control material and others. Sometime this month, sometime during July, with the extra rain we've had, that tends to spread the grubs out to where we don't get a lot in anyone's place. We recommend in that case that you may not want to treat, but watch your lawn early in August, maybe cut through the turf, pull it back. If you have at least 10 to 12 grubs per square foot, then treat with triclofan, which is sold as Dylox, D-Y-L-O-X. And this will kill the grubs in 3 days, but it's gone in 5, so you don't want to treat with that until the grubs are there.
All right. Well, thank you very much once again for being here.
Okay, glad to be here.
Phil Nixon, he's Extension Entomologist, Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at U of I. Every once in a while, he's here to answer these kind of questions. In the meantime, you can always call, look in the phone book, look for your local Extension office. And
it'll be under University of Illinois or the county name.
So you can call them and ask questions. And if they can't answer the questions, Phil is the guy that they talk to.